Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Zero the Educate. I'm Mohit Mehra and today we have Suyash Chaudhary from IDFC Mutual Fund with us. We initially wanted to have this conversation with Suyash sometime back in March, but given the situation back then, it seemed like the world was ending and everybody was in the middle of adjusting to new realities. Since then, the markets have been surprising to say the least. And also, there have been a few events in the debt mutual fund space, which have further highlighted just how important it is to get your debt allocation right and not to take it for granted. So in this conversation with Suyash, we'll talk about just that, the first principles of investing in debt. Now, this title is based on another talk that Suyash recently gave, and we'll link that in the show notes as well. Suyash, before we talk about bonds and debt markets, let's talk a little bit about you and your journey. How did you get started in the world of finance, and why boring fixed income versus glamorous equities, and how did you end up at IDFC Mutual Fund?
Thank you first, Mohit, so much for inviting me. I'm glad that we are having this conversation now instead of in March, because then, you know, a lot of our views would have been proven wrong by now. Today, we have the luxury of, you know, minting fresh views for you. And therefore, you know, that's probably a good thing. I do firmly believe that some of life's biggest decisions are made by chance. So you can spend more time selecting a pair of shoes or a shirt compared to some of, you know, the more wider ramification oriented decisions that, you know, are made in life. A lot of it is chance. You know, if you are lucky, you can, with the benefit of hindsight, think about these and reminiscence to say that these were good chances. In some cases, as probably you allude that I ended up in fixed income instead of equities, you may say that it could have been unfortunate. Not from my standpoint at all, though. So, you know, I always had a very large interest in economics. So I wanted to pursue economics in college as well, post which not a very thought through plan, but you know, MBA seemed like the logical decision, and therefore I went for it. While doing MBA, you know, what I really wanted to do was sales and marketing, and you know, that's what I was aiming for. You know, at some juncture, the rigors of FMCG marketing was brought home to me. And therefore, I made a speedy readjustment, you know, into the world of finance. It was a forgiving year. It was year 2000 when I graduated from IIM Calcutta. I say forgiving year because the job market was very robust. And therefore, it allowed me to make a last minute pivot and come into banking to start with. I started with Deutsche Bank. So that was one turn of the wheel, if you will. Second, you know, in Deutsche Bank, I joined a consulting division. And by 2001, you know, I was prepared to pursue a career in consulting. As things would be, that consulting unit was shut down. I was pursuing other, you know, opportunities in the market for consulting. I had an afternoon off, so I had 2-3 hours to kill. And the Standard Chartered Mutual Fund was inviting applications. So even though I wasn't really interested, I said, you know, I have 3 hours and it won't hurt. And one thing led to another. I got employed with Standard Chartered Mutual Fund, first in their pensions management division and then their fixed income funds management divisions. And that's how the journey in fixed income investments started. I had really nothing to do with it. It was, you know, it basically, you know, just a series of, I would call them happy accidents. Which led me to this career.
Suyash, for somebody new, can you give us a broad outline of how the Indian bond markets work? Who are the biggest players? What are the biggest segments? And so on.
So, you know, I think one of the least understood facets about the Indian bond market is the liquidity that that market contains. And, you know, when one hears about a lot of asset allocation decisions, from investors, from advisors, one hardly hears about taking account of liquidity in the market. And if you see, you know, most of negative investor experiences over the last few years really pertain to the lack of adequate liquidity or price discovery, which has, in many cases, disallowed people to exit positions, or it has disallowed the even discovery of prices, which means that sometimes prices fall in step functions because in an illiquid market, suddenly prices get discovered at a very different price point. And therefore, you know, one of the key things about the debt market that you have to, keep in mind is that liquidity changes very dramatically from sub-asset class to sub-asset class within the debt market. And by which I mean, if you see our government bond market, it is probably one of the best and most liquid in the world. We have a very, 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 efficient trading system for government bonds. And that's a market and specifically a few securities within that market where liquidity price discovery is probably one of the best in the world. The market for AAA or high quality corporate bonds, although does not throw up too much secondary market volume, and that's also to do with the nature of participants, and most of the participants in the market are buy and hold participants. So, you asked about the biggest players. So the biggest players in the government bond market will probably be banks. In the corporate bond market, it would be, investors like EPFO, LIC, etc. And most of these mandates may be buy and hold. So which is why the AAA corporate bond market may not show too much secondary market liquidity. But if you have need to liquidate, in most cases, it provides you that liquidity. Barring, exceptional circumstances like, for example, 2008-09 brief period there, and a very few, brief days in early March, April of this year. From there, as you go down the credit curve, liquidity rapidly starts to diminish in the Indian bond market. And also the nature of credits start to become, more divergent. So, when you say that AAA versus AA spreads, as an example, although there is an aggregate analysis that you can do, but within AA, there is a sea of issuers, and some may be much more liquid than the others. And therefore, as you go down the curve and into more and more the realm of credit-oriented strategies, you start to trade away liquidity by a very large margin. And that is something that investors need to be very, very clearly aware of. And frankly, that's one of the main drivers of our philosophy at IDFC Mutual Fund on how we run our fixed income business.
So just to put this in perspective in terms of how important liquidity is and how the bond markets have been evolving, through your career, how have you seen the bond markets evolve, and have they evolved? Has anything changed, or is it pretty much the same?
No, absolutely. There is a very large evolution, both for the bond market and the mutual fund industry operating within it. So as is the nature of progression or development for any ecosystem, we were much more rudimentary, let's say, when I started my career. So the entire market was a phone-based market. Price discovery, therefore, used to be significantly worse than what it is today. Mandates for various, investment entities used to be slightly more broadly or loosely defined, which threw up a lot of risks and bad interpretations at various points in time as well. Over a period of time, market liquidity has definitely improved. Like I said, the government bond market has obviously almost turned out to be in fact, I would say it is a world-class market as far as price discovery and liquidity are concerned. AAA corporate bonds are reasonably liquid, but like I said, secondary market volume is not the best measure of that. And especially over the last few years, mandates have been more tightly defined. So therefore, risk management, the communication of a product to an investor, the defining of parameters of your operations have all become more precise and more tightly defined, which are all very welcome steps in the natural progression of a bond market.
Suyash, you mentioned that the bond market used to be a phone-based market. Could you elaborate on that? What do you mean by that?
So if I recall my bosses trading in the market, in the years, early part of 2000, most of, let's say government bonds were also getting executed via phone. So you used to line up bids and offers and then hit them. Many times the propensity was that when you have hit them, you find that the counterparty has run away. And there is absolutely no, way, barring moral suasion or a gentleman's agreement, that you could, bring them back to the table. From there, if you see, yes, the corporate bond market is still phone-based, although there is a move to, a screen-based electronic platform there as well recently, and which everyone is trying to encourage to grow. And most of government bonds are screen-based. Plus, I would think the market is now run by a more tightly defined code of conduct, which means that even in a phone transaction, if you have hit something, you better honor it. If nothing, you are, bound by some sort of a code of conduct, which is applied, most of the times. And in the screen-based market, there is absolutely no such problem where transactions in the case of government bond screen-based market or the market for overnight lending are settled the moment you hit. In fact, settlement is run by a central clearing agency. So, you are no longer in a realm where execution carries very high costs. You are uncertain even if execution will go through as well. We are, in a very different regime, a very different world. And credit goes to all the market developers, participants, as well as regulators of the market in going through on this journey.
Suyash, speaking from an investor's perspective, a very rudimentary question, it might also seem like a dumb question to you, but we are constantly surprised that people keep getting this wrong. At its core, what is the need for debt in a portfolio? Why even want debt in a portfolio?
Very good question. I would define it more broadly to say, the need for stable income, counter-cyclical products in your portfolio. So debt here could be defined, including, other coupon-bearing instruments, including bank deposits, and of course, the entire gamut of mutual fund products. See, any fundamental basic asset allocation model should have cyclical and counter-cyclical products. That's because the nature of the markets as well as the economy is to follow cycles. So in case of financial markets, there are greed and fear cycles, boom and bust cycles. In the case of the economy, there are recession and resurgence cycles, right? And that's a fact of life. That's the nature of the beast. And therefore, your asset allocation table has to mirror this reality. Now, pro-cyclical assets are assets that, at least in theory, tend to do well in the boom phase, in the resurgence phase, in the so-called greed phase of the market. And these are the ones that give you slightly more than just steady state returns. Ordinarily, you would put assets like, let's say, equities, commodities, maybe real estate, and credit, which are all positively correlated to economic cycles and a rising or greed oriented financial market cycle. But equally, you will suffer busts, you will suffer recessions, you will suffer fear, and therefore it's almost equally important to have counter cyclical assets in your portfolio. And what are these counter cyclical assets? They are the backbone of your asset allocation table, and this is where quality fixed income comes in. So by definition, counter-cyclical assets can only, some people may think partly gold, for example, may be serving that purpose. But remember, that's not an interest-bearing asset, right? But if you want steady income, if you want counter-cyclicality, you have to have quality fixed income. So to think that, you won't have fixed income is to basically suggest that markets will never have a fear cycle. there will never be a recession, there will never be a bust. And that's simply not true. So instead of, jumping about, which is what, generally commentary is around, because, as human beings, we have a great bias for action. To keep flipping between, asset classes, depending upon whether we are in a boom or bust cycle. And almost as a rule, these decisions are made reactively rather than proactively. So most times people end up taking them wrong. Instead of doing that, just consider boom bust cycles, fear greed cycles as a truth of life. Every few years, these cycles turn. And therefore, build an asset allocation table in accordance with this long-term series of cycles, which means that you have counter-cyclical assets in quality fixed income and you have pro-cyclical assets, which is, equity, real estate, commodities, etc. And if you think, you are closer to a greed cycle peaking off, you simply start to increase the component of your counter-cyclical assets. And even if you don't, if you keep the two profiles static and you link them to, let's say, your risk appetite or your age, etc., this will serve you well over a period of time. And you may actually have the luxury to just, sit back and watch people, running around when these cycles assert themselves from time to time.
So, Suyash, what you're saying is the primary objective for somebody who is doing their debt allocation, doing their portfolio allocation and looking at debt should be to safeguard from various types of risks that they might encounter. Is there any other reason that they might want to look at?
It's to primarily, I would imagine, to build counter-cyclicality. And secondly, also to produce some sort of a backbone to your running income. So remember, also within one phase of an economic or financial market cycle, returns in growth-oriented assets may not be evenly distributed. So you may, because markets always, work on a forward pricing principle, as you have very easily seen this year as well, in the deepest of gloom was the best time to invest in growth assets. And now, you are piling on commentary after commentary of bullishness, but you have you have seen that repricing happening. Obviously, that's not my area of expertise, so I will not comment on that. The thing is that growth assets do not, by definition, almost distribute your returns uniformly over a period of time. So apart from building counter-cyclicality, fixed income also gives you a basis for running income over a period of time. So obviously, in fixed income as well, return distribution is not even, but the fluctuation is obviously lesser than that in growth assets.
Suyash, segueing to the Indian perspective here, in the Indian context, we tend to be overly exposed to fixed income through PPF, through insurance. Do you think that people need to be invested in debt mutual funds in the Indian setting?
Look, so the way I see this also our philosophy on fixed income generally is to basically stand back and look at what stage of evolution in a cycle are we? What stage of evolution of financial literacy, market development, awareness are we? And, although we have, like we discussed before, taken great leaps over the last few years, you could argue that this is still a market where, as you introduce more complexity, you need to take the onus that the investor understands what they're buying, right? Because it's not a market where the level of general understanding or even the level of depth of communication by advisors is, let's say at a level where probably developed markets are. So I would consider this as a natural, evolution cycle where, till very recently, probably 10 years back, the proportion of fixed deposits, even in large corporate treasury investments, was very high, right? And over the last 10 years, at least, the bigger institutional investors have found more value in either entering the market directly or via mutual funds. And I would think over a period of time, this percolates more into retail as well. I think what we can't do is try and jump that process, right? And jumping that process in one way, which, you know, again, it's something that we have disagreed with over the last few years, is to start to introduce, let's say, credit risk funds to mass retail or, you know, very high carry and therefore very illiquid credit risk funds to mass retail. I'm not saying that's entirely wrong, but I'm saying this is something that needs to be done carefully because you can't jump the evolution cycle. So in an environment where, like you rightly observed, the total penetration of mutual funds itself is relatively, although growing, but still nascent, you first have to lead with simpler products where the, you know, the experience variation can be controlled almost, right? And then you introduce over a period of time more complex products. So if at all, you know, collectively, what we need to understand in my view, in our view, is that you can't, you know, sequence the cart before the horse. So at this stage, probably the biggest macro logic or utility of debt mutual funds is to incentivize financialization of savings by making, you know, financial savings more effortless, right? So I think the predominant, therefore, objective is to produce more simple products where the range of experience is more contained.
Suyash, since we're talking about investment products and asset allocation here, a lot is like preached about asset allocation and how people should make sure to think about it and balance, rebalance whenever the need arises. A lot of investors, they sometimes put disproportionate attention to the equity side of things, and the fixed income part tends to take a like backseat. So what should be something that the investor who's looking at formalizing his asset allocation plan be looking at when it comes to fixed income? What are there any pointers that you could like direct them toward?
So I think a fundamental flip that is required in the way, you know, one looks at these things is to let asset allocation be dictated by your risk profile, not what returns you seek. If you see most of conversations that happen, so for example, one conversation today would be, oh, returns on quality fixed income have collapsed. You know, now let's try something which is better, right? Now, if you examine what this statement says, this statement basically says that there is a threshold return that I definitely need and I cannot compromise below that. My risk profile is variable. So rather than saying that my need for return is fixed and my risk profile is variable, you have to flip this around to say that my return is dictated by the market, but the risk profile is constant and that is what I need to dictate. The entire conversation is wrong on this, right? So the question that needs to be asked is that just because returns have collapsed to 4 or 5% in quality fixed income, has that made you a riskier investor or an investor with a greater risk appetite? Or has something changed in your personal profile or the environment in your perception that is making you a more risk-oriented investor? If it's the latter, then by all means, go ahead. If it's the former, then, you know, that's cause for alarm, which again means that, you know, asset allocation decisions are basis and need for at least a threshold level of return, no matter what, where the risk profile keeps fluctuating, which in my view is entirely the wrong way of looking at it.
I think you guys are the only AMC to categorize debt funds into core and satellite buckets in your fact sheets. For somebody who's new, could you like elaborate on how this core and satellite framework works and what it is to their like asset allocation portfolio?
Sure. So it is in some sense a summation of everything that we have discussed so far. So what we say, and this is, you know, in some sense, trying to offer an asset allocation table but leaving out the relative weights to the individual risk appetite of the investor or the advisor. So what we are saying is that fixed income can be divided into three buckets: liquidity, core, and satellite. Liquidity is for largely your cash management needs. So basically liquid and overnight funds, and that, you know, you can keep aside because, you know, that is money that you require for cash management. Then your investment buckets become core and satellite. And these are split as per risk profile. So fundamentally, there are two risks that you take in fixed income. Obviously, there are many risks, but two you know, major risks, it's duration and credit risk. And therefore, core bucket of products are products that control for both duration and credit risk. And the satellite bucket of products are those which can take higher amounts of duration or credit risk or both. And we have basically allocated or slotted our products to the best of our assessment into core and satellite, taking care that the manufacturing of the products on the ongoing basis also accounts for the fact of where they are slotted. So there is a set of core products which should form the bulk of your fixed income asset allocation, because remember, we said that is what gives you counter cyclicality and some stability of income. And there should be some allocation to satellite, which takes higher credit or higher duration risk. Notice this flips, you know, what traditionally used to be thought, that if you have 6 month money, there is fund X. If you have 1 year money, there's fund Y. And you would have seen historically that as your time horizon grew, you were being encouraged to take on more duration or more credit risk necessarily. This table does not adhere to that principle. This table says that even if you are a 10-year, 15-year or a perpetual fixed income investor, your risk appetite will define what portion goes into core, which has controlled duration and credit risk, and what portion goes into satellite. Now, within core, there are various products where the minimum investment horizon could range from, let's say, 6 months to 3 years. So, for example, if you're coming into a money market fund within the core category, your investment minimum investment horizon could be, let's say, 6 months, hypothetically. If you're coming into a short-term or a corporate bond kind of fund, your minimum investment horizon could be 2 to 3 years. So within core and satellite, you could have different minimum investment horizons that probably is suitable. But that does, you know, but if you're a conservative investor, and even if you're a perpetual fixed income investor, it could be that 80% of your allocation always goes into core and 20% only goes into satellite.
So yes, now that we've spoken about asset allocation and portfolio construction at some length, would love to hear your thoughts on how an investor should analyze while investing in a debt fund. More often than not, investors rely on past returns, star ratings, and buy-sell lists, and so on. And the last 3 years have shown that some of these decisions based on these criteria might come back to haunt them. So what would be ideally the things that after selecting and finding out their asset allocation, an investor looks at to find if or if not that mutual fund or that scheme works for him?
So your starting point would be, you know, thinking about your fixed income asset allocation into liquidity, core, and satellite bucketing. And the reason I say that is that, you know, that is how you are gatekeeping your investments. And then you are asking the fund manager or the manufacturer to show you products that fit into these three buckets. So for example, if it's a liquid fund, which is part of your liquidity bucket, you can't run a liquid fund in a very aggressive fashion. So you can't just, you know, fill it with very low rated CPs, etc., because it's a cash management tool for you, and you needn't necessarily maximize return in a fund like that. Similarly, when you're looking for core products, you need to be very clear that the product's philosophy is very clearly defined and articulated by the fund manager, by the manufacturer, that this is what this fund will or will not do. Because you do see a tendency for managers to completely flip risk profile for many products almost overnight. So yes, there are products in the satellite category that, you know, allow for it. For example, a dynamic bond fund, I am free to run whatever maturity I want to run. That is the mandate of the product. But equally, in the core category, you need to have products where the mandates are much better defined. And if the fund manager is not defining those, then probably they are not servicing your core investment requirements. And then similarly you choose some satellite products. Now obviously, like you said, a lot of decision making almost embedded in the human psyche is basis the rear view mirror. One needn't even elaborate on, you know, the risks embedded there because they are very obvious. You know, the rear view is hardly giving you too much information. In fact, even the way the rear view is getting consumed is probably wrong because people look at, let's say, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year returns at this point in time, right? Whereas if you have to, you know, analyze rear view mirror, you should look at rolling returns over a longer period of time because then that captures the various ups and downs of a fund's journey. Whereas if a fund is having a very good streak at any point in time, in all probability over a period of time, their 1, 2, 3 year returns at this point in time will start to look very good. So there may be a significant difference between, let's say, rolling 3 year returns for the last 3 years versus 3 year returns today at this point in time, right? So the first thing I would say is that, in fact, the second thing I would say, the first is to first understand philosophy and how you will bucket products into the three categories. The second is, if you have to look at history, look at it in the right way. And third is, when you look at some of this external research, you know, just see where it's lacking and where it's not. And, you know, one good way to also look at it is look at past star ratings and see whether they were in time able to warn you. So, for example, you know, one of the deficiencies for many of these so-called star ratings historically would have been that they would have captured only volatility as a measure of risk. They would not have assigned any or much weightage to credit risk. So for example, if it is excess return divided by standard deviation, a portfolio which is running higher credit risk but lower maturity, till something bad happens to the credits there, will always score higher. And that in fact probably was the case for many star ratings over a period of time. So, and these are very basic things. So, you know, sometimes you wonder why, I mean, is there not a widespread acknowledgement that credit is also a risk alongside duration? So why this, you know, selective focus only on duration risk when we analyze funds? So do consume them, not selectively, but holistically. And finally, you know, and some people are beginning to do this work. Fixed income platforms also need to be audited for their long-term philosophy, their ability to have stuck to a philosophy at the cost of losing AUM, losing business at various points in time. And the philosophy should be clearly articulated. Because unless you know what your manufacturer is manufacturing, how will you plug it in your asset allocation table? So this does require a bit of work, but I'm grateful to see that there are people already doing that work.
So yes, you spoke about the mandate of the fund and how an investor needs to like make sure that when they're selecting the fund, not only does the mandate fit into their scheme of things, but also the fund manager has stuck to the original mandate. And again, with the philosophy, if the fund manager is sticking to it. So for somebody who's new, how do they like find this information? Where do they get it? I mean, what do they have to check to know that somebody has stuck to their philosophy? Would it be available on the AMC's website? Would they have to go through some of the fact sheets? What would they have to do?
So, you know, I can speak for ourselves. We have tried through various tools, including this core satellite approach, liquidity core satellite approach, to be able to demonstrate the risk profile over a period of time. Our fund philosophy is also relatively clearly articulated. There are certain new innovations which the regulator you know, is putting forward more aggressively, which are quite healthy and will help the investors. One I could think of is this riskometer, where you will get probably a better handle of the risk, both duration and credit risk profile, as well as liquidity profile, et cetera, of funds. So there are, you know, incremental developments which will help facilitate you being able to pick the right product. I would also say that you have to come with the right frame of mind. So if you're coming with the frame of mind of maximizing returns, see, in fixed income where, and especially for shorter maturity products where bulk of return comes from carry, you get a lot of chalk and cheese comparisons. Because if, let's say, there is a quality-oriented product, even in the money market category, or even in the low-duration category, for example, you know, what's happening these days is a case in point. You may have a 50, 75 basis point yield differential between two low-duration funds. But they are chalk and cheese. You know, one is focused on, you know, very conservative credit risk profile, and the other is not so much very conservative. I'm not opining on which is good and which is bad. All I'm saying is that there is a reason why those two are different. So, you know, many times performance measurement, especially in fixed income, is very complex because a lot of return comes from carry. And optimization of carry many times is a trade-off between how much risk you want to take, credit risk you want to take, illiquidity risk you want to take versus what return you want to generate. And that's also anchored in your philosophy or product positioning. So you also have to make the right comparisons, which is why probably, you know, taking the help of an advisor in the initial phase is a useful way to go.
So yes, you spoke about the riskometer and how it's a part of the data that mutual fund schemes are providing. Could you elaborate on what the factors are that the riskometer is like taking into account to tell you how risky it is?
So early days, I think the rollout is imminent. But, you know, it is a multi-dimensional approach and in some sense gives you one composite score that is capturing, you know, duration, credit, illiquidity, and therefore, you know, this problem that we referred to of people analyzing duration risk selectively probably gets surmounted to some extent. You would hopefully also see, you know, let's say, riskometer scores for two low duration funds to be different. And that gives you an avenue for inquiry to basically talk to the fund manager, their representatives, to say that, you know, why is this different? So, you know, what is it that you are doing that makes your product carry a higher risk score than, you know, an XYZ product in the market? And then, you know, I'm not saying that that product is bad. All I'm saying is it gives you fresh information, new information, additional information to be able to make your call.
Suyash, in one of your talks, you had spoken about diversification and the pitfalls of diversification in debt or false diversification. That is to allocating to companies of the same promoters or cyclical companies and so on. How should investors look at diversification and what are the pitfalls that they should avoid?
Look, so one of the things that does not sit very well with me personally is how diversification gets flogged around like a truism. You know, it's like saying that I'm always truthful and how good am I, right? So obviously you cannot doubt when I say that I'm always truthful that I must be good because it is a truism that telling the truth is a good quality. And therefore, all other things being constant, what is known as ceteris paribus, more diversification is obviously better than less diversification. But that's posing, you know, the problem very simplistically. So I've even seen, you know, many people flogging the number of securities that they have to show how riskless their portfolio is, while at the same time, you know, talking about the very high YTM that they're offering. So in some sense, you know, why that one is slightly difficult to digest is that it's almost posing no trade-off in front of the investor, and which is a very risky thing if you think about, because there are always trade-offs. So if you position a proposal to say that it's not risky and yet it gives you very good returns, then you know, if the investor finds you as credible, you are basically you know, projecting the best of every world, and you are not putting up a trade-off at all. Whereas I mean, unless the world works differently in these micro settings, there is always a trade-off. If you're wanting higher return, you have to have higher risk. So why not just go out and say that, you know, there is higher credit risk embedded in this fund and that's why you're getting better return, or you have the potential of getting a better return. So one should not you know, look at this as a truism. One should look to derive value or, you know, add value from, you know, pitching diversification. So if you are diversified across 20 instruments, but that block of 20 instruments is illiquid because of being very lower rated or not having sufficient depth in their secondary market, then, you know, you could potentially not be benefiting too much from the diversification. I mean, I would think exactly the same thing, that with everything else remaining constant, more diversification is obviously good, which is a truism. But when you are being shown diversification, you also have to ask other questions, that can it compensate for the more aggressive credit quality that the fund is running? And if so, how? Many times I find that not enough questions are being asked. A lot of things are being taken at face value.
On the same note, Suyash, do you think we have like enough quality issuers in India to of, let's say, AAA rated bonds to build a quality and safe portfolio?
There are. We have a fixed income franchise, which is largely AAA and sovereign. And it's a reasonably large franchise. So we can't say there are not enough issuers. Yes, when you're building a AAA book and you're building, when you're choosing basis your own analysis, a set of AAAs which you think are stronger within the universe of AAAs, you will not, you know, get 2-3% per issuer as an example. Because yes, I mean, I can't probably find 50, you know, subset of AAA issuers. So it does mean that, you know, single issuer is slightly higher. But that is, you know, one more trade-off that you potentially have to look at.
Suyash, going back to the truisms and the thumb rules that you were talking about, with debt investing, there are like multiple thumb rules that float around. One would be to stick with 100% AAA papers. One would be to stick with only banking and PSU funds, maybe to stick with gilts, among other things. In your opinion, what would be some like terrible thumb rules or truisms that you've come across, and some like nice ones which people should keep in mind while investing?
So probably two of the three that you mentioned are terrible. No, obviously, you are just quoting from what you hear. I don't mean any disrespect from that. So yes, stick to only AAA runs the risk of sub-optimizing your return, because basically what you're doing is you're just sticking to a core bucket. You are not allowing for any satellite allocation. If your risk profile is that conservative, by all means, go ahead. But it may not be the best asset allocation table. But the other two are indeed alarming. One is stick to gilts, like you said. That completely ignores duration risk now. So again, you know, flipping in binary terms, either only think about duration risk or completely ignore duration risk. So, you know, a 30-year government bond can potentially wipe you out as much as, you know, some of the lower rated credits could if interest rates move adversely. So whenever you think about an investment, do remember that there are these two risks that you have to mitigate, duration as well as credit risk. You know, so post March, April, we did see a lot of investors, you know, panicking and either going into overnight funds or gilt funds. Probably going to overnight funds then was not a very good idea because they would have missed out on a lot of the yield fall that happened subsequently. Your third about banking PSU funds, I just don't know what that means because there is no one single banking PSU strategy. A better carve out is to carve out in core satellite terms. That is the risk profile conservative enough on credit and duration risk, no matter what the name of the fund is, for you to bucket it into your core allocations. Because remember, a banking PSU fund can be loaded with additional tier one bonds. Again, no commentary on those bonds, but if somebody says they are not riskier than pure fixed income instruments, they're probably deluding themselves. And therefore, a banking PSU fund loaded with additional tier one bonds may belong in your satellite allocation. And therefore, you may not want to put more than, let's say, 20% of your allocation there. Whereas if it belongs in the core bucket, which would be a conservative credit profile banking PSU funds, then you could potentially look to allocate much more there.
Suyash, for somebody new, could you like elaborate on what additional tier one bonds are and what are the risks that they come with?
So there again, you know, one befuddling narrative is often put that an XYZ bank is such a good bank, so what will happen to their additional tier one bond? You know, like we discussed before, it's probably a collective responsibility to continue to, you know, given the position of privilege that we hold, and I don't say this lightly, position of privilege in terms of, you know, being fortunate enough to be holding the positions that we do, to have the, you know, the faith of so many investors who have allocated their money and, you know, who have made you your guardian, their guardian for your money. It is probably embedded in our roles to also try to continue to develop the level of understanding. This is a very simplistic statement to say that, you know, XYZ bank, if that bank closes, then the country will shut down and therefore I should continue to buy that bond. See, AT1 bonds are quasi-equity instruments. Okay, now it's true that the stronger the bank, the better the probability that it behaves like a fixed income instrument. And the weaker the bank, the lower the probability that it behaves like a fixed income instrument. And you have seen some extreme cases in the market where the whole thing got written off because it was a very weak bank, right? So probably that statement is not very far from the truth, but it misses the nuance, it misses the shade. And unless you have some principles of allocation, it's not as if you can see every risk that is going to come. Right. So over the last few years, did we see every risk that came? No. It's just that, you know, we stuck to a certain principle of allocation and that served us well. And that's not to, you know, beat our drums and say that nothing can happen to us. But what we have found in our journey is that that principle of allocation serves you well, even when you can't foresee the risk at many times. So the simple point here is that the AT1 is a quasi-equity instrument. At a level of stress, it has loss absorption features. Therefore, you cannot compare it to a fixed coupon bearing instrument of the same issuer. So what you should remember is that, like I said, the stronger the bank, the more the probability that B is like a fixed income instrument. But it's not a fixed income instrument. It's a quasi-equity instrument. And therefore, what portion of your fixed income allocation you want to allocate there should accordingly be controlled.
Suyash, there have been like several mishaps in the high yield fund space, and the common argument you hear is that investors will be ultimately compensated because something in a diversified basket of high yield papers will pay off. But on the first blush, if you look at just the numbers, these credit risk funds have kept up, have like not really kept up with the corporate bond funds, which have a far higher safety profile. Would it be fair to say here that investors should like completely just avoid the high yield or the credit risk funds from the portfolio?
So there are two aspects of this. The first is from the investor standpoint, the other is from the manufacturer's or the fund manager standpoint. From an investor standpoint, you know, it's clear a credit risk fund is part of your satellite bucket because it runs higher credit risk. And therefore, you should allocate, but you should allocate a proportion that is in line with what a satellite bucket of allocation should suggest. In fact, let me restate, it's not necessary that you allocate. If your risk profile is such that you don't want satellite bucket allocations, or within satellite bucket, you don't want potential binary outcomes as credit risk funds can sometimes give, you can very well easily live your life without allocation there as well. However, the framework for allocation, what I meant is that credit risk funds belong to the satellite bucket of allocation, not the core bucket of allocation. And as a principle of asset allocation, bulk of your fixed income allocation should go to core and some marginal amount to satellite depending upon your risk profile. By the way, active duration funds are also satellite bucket. because they can change duration, even though the element of credit risk may be very little there. From a manufacturer's standpoint, when I'm manufacturing a product like a credit risk fund, I need to remember that I am not a static balance sheet, I'm a flow product, right? So one of the things that we have argued against a lot over the last 4 or 5 years is even the propensity for managers to call what they're doing lending instead of investing. And this is something we were very grateful for the regulator to come out and say that, you know, you are not lending, you are investing. And there's a world of difference between the two words. Lending means that you are almost running a static balance sheet where your liability profile is very much given to you. And you are making certain loans where you are provisioning and there is capital buffers available on the liability side to write off should the need arise. Investing is done in investment vehicles. In this case, they are flow products where, you know, money comes to you. Frankly, the cost of that money is zero for you because you are not bound to produce any return for that money. And you invest that money in the market. At any point in time, that money can ask for, you know, their rightful entitlement back. They may ask for their investments back, at which point in time you will sell the assets that you're holding and return the money. So you are an investor as a mutual fund manager, you're not a lender. The moment you create a credit fund book, which is at the mercy of you controlling your liability profile, which basically means that, you know, you try to, you know, gate the liability profile through various exit load structures and tranches, etc. You are basically in the realm of a balance sheet manager, not a mutual fund manager. So to cut a long story short, what I'm saying is that for an investor, it's part of the satellite bucket. For the fund manager, even within the credit risk fund category, the endeavor should be that the largest part, if possible, of the credit risk product should be such that it can be liquidated in the secondary market. Now, obviously, there are constraints, like we discussed before, that as you go down the credit curve, liquidity becomes more challenging. But even in, let's say, the AA space, there'll be enough credits. So even the months of March and April showed you, which are liquid, which push comes to shove can be sold. And that is what the bulk of the mandate should be. If you want to construct a higher carry, even lower liquidity product, then an open-ended mutual fund is definitely not the vehicle to be doing that.
From the investor's perspective, in your view, what should be the biggest lesson that they should like never forget given the series of train wrecks that we've seen in the entire debt space in the last 3 years, starting with ILFS?
You have to go back and see. So what amazes me personally all the time is that, see, a credit risk fund is an alpha product, right? Because you are getting much more than the risk-free rate, or you have the potential to earn much more than the risk-free rate because of a certain credit selection by the fund manager, right? And therefore, it is their alpha skills that you're buying into. Much like in, let's say, a dynamic bond fund, you are buying into the alpha skills of duration management of the manager. Now, there have been times when dynamic bond funds have suffered quite a bit, right? Similarly, defaults, downgrades, erosion of value in credit risk funds could be termed as a loss of alpha. The question, however, is how can the loss of alpha in an alpha product inflict so much pain, right? Because the duration fund industry, although has inflicted pain from time to time, never inflicted as much pain on investors. And it again boils down to the same thing, that credit risk funds were in forms which were called credit risk funds and sometimes called other things as well, were consumed too much. So the amount outstanding within credit risk funds was far more than what either the underlying market could support or the risk profile of the investors could support. And it again, you know, speaks to the lack of an robust asset allocation model, which could have signaled that credit risk funds are part of your satellite bucket allocation only. So at their peak, if I remember correctly, duration funds, which have been in existence for 20 years and credit risk funds were like 6-7 years into existence, credit risk funds were double the size of the duration fund industry. So what that industry could not build in 20 years, or not 20, let's say 16, 17 years, this industry built twice of that in 6-7 years. And why did that happen? Again, you know, so everything is linked in some way. Again, this dominance of considering only volatility as risk. So if you could offer products which were higher carry, lower duration, which gave you a semblance of, you know, static, almost static returns, you know, and static and very good returns over a period of time, you could in some sense position that there is no trade-off, right? That you're getting returns and as well as low risk. And again, this ties up to one thing that we discussed before. It's a false trade-off, right? So had only 20% of, and 20 is just a hypothetical number. I've used it many times. It's just an illustrative example. There's no science to it. Neither is it a recommendation. As you know, we can't make those recommendations. It's just an illustrative example. So suppose 20% was going into credit risk funds, the size of that industry would have been much smaller, right? Over a period of time. And therefore the damage it could have inflicted on you would have been much lower. So again, you know, the biggest lesson to learn, and not pointing fingers at all, is to just have a robust asset allocation model. And these are all first principles. So you can have a view that may conflict with what I'm saying, but can you say that you don't go in boom and bust cycles? Can you say that many times you can't predict when those cycles will happen and therefore you can't opportunistically just get out? Can you say that credit risk is a more unwieldy risk to manage owing to the lack of liquidity? And if you can't say those things, then you have to, by definition, adopt an asset allocation table, something similar to what we are saying.
So Yash, to conclude with where we're standing currently, right now, the entire environment is like very low interest rate yielding, and there are people who are predominantly savers and who are retirees, and given the low interest rates right now, it is somewhat natural to for people to chase yields, and we've already been hearing stories about people being sold some very risky high yielding products in forms which are like mis-selling, definitely. And in such an environment, what could be like to-dos for these savers and these retirees? What would be your advice to them? What should they be doing?
See, one has to be very sympathetic to what's happening. At the same time, it is part of a cycle. So think about savers and investment makers. I won't call them investors because then you can get confused as financial investors. So people who commit investments into the economy is what investment makers I'm referring to. And savers are people who provide the savings for making those investments. At various points in time, the relative importance of savers versus investment makers keeps shifting. So when an economic cycle is busting, investment collapses, and therefore to regenerate that cycle, you need to give preference, as it were, to the needs of investment makers as compared to the need for savers, which means that you are temporarily left with excess savings in the system. And therefore the requirement for the economy is to get the investment cycle going, even the consumption cycle going, which requires lower interest rates, which requires the terms of trades to shift from savers to investors slash consumers. However, as the economy starts to come back to life and the need for continued investment slash consumption means that you need more savings, the need of the savers automatically starts to come back into the forefront, right? So, and this is the nature of the game. Just as you have boom bust cycles, which is where I think we started this conversation, you also have at various points in time, the need for one of these agents overwhelming the need of the others, right? So at this juncture, the priority is to get an investment cycle going, and therefore the terms of trade have shifted in favor of the investment maker as compared to the saver. There will come a time when savings are required to finance these investments, and therefore the savers will also have to be given appropriate compensation. And remember, India is a country where investments to GDP actually is quite subdued. And therefore, if we are actually ambitious for that 6, 7, 8% sustained growth path, we need higher investments, and therefore we will need those to get financed through higher savings. And therefore, for a very long period of time, we can't afford to not look at interest of the saver. Through all of this, what I'm saying is that it's a patience game, right? Probably not a very good idea is that for that, you know, 1 to 2 year period where the need of the saver was put behind that of the investment maker, the saver lets go of their risk profile, right? And then ventures into all sorts of things, which then become difficult to clean up down the line. Because that means that, you know, that element of your asset allocation table that was meant to give you stability, you have compromised upon. It means that the one variable that you could have controlled, which is your risk appetite, you have, you know, kind of flexed with to chase, you know, that additional return. And that doesn't look like a very good idea. So there is no structural argument in India that you have a multi-year cycle where the saver will continually be not taken care of. Because like I mentioned, we do need an investment cycle for which we do need financing over a period of time. It is largely a patience game for now.
Suyash, let's talk a little bit about you. You've been in the Indian markets for a while, and I'm sure like all of our listeners and viewers right now, they would want to know how you personally invest. What is your personal investment philosophy? You might have made some mistakes over these years. Is there anything that you would want people to know in terms of what you've learned from your mistakes and some takeaways for them?
So, you know, for the longest time, you know, the profession used to completely consume me. And I just never paid too much attention to my own, you know, savings in the sense what they were doing. I was almost shamed into it one time. I remember that, you know, I was probably renewing a deposit or something. And, you know, the person said, aren't you a fund manager with Standard Chartered Mutual Fund? And then it occurred to me, why don't I pay attention to my own savings a little bit also? And it doesn't take as much time as I thought it does. And that is when I did adopt some sort of a loose asset allocation table, which is, you know, largely oriented towards a combination of growth assets and income generating assets. So in some sense, you know, one is practicing as well what one has now been preaching for the last one and a half hours. So, you know, you do need that combination of growth and income assets. Now, depends on your risk profile, depends on, you know, how much the need for income generating assets is. And yes, it is linked to age, but it's also linked to risk profile, you know, so that that determines what portion of growth assets you are in. It also depends on which part of the economic cycle you are at. Probably on the margin, I have tended to, you know, change that table slightly more than a more passive investor would have done, depending upon what my view of where we are in an asset cycle is. But fundamentally, have stuck to an asset allocation table of a cyclical and counter-cyclical asset variety, which we spoke about.
Suyash, for somebody who's not, let's say, directly linked with the markets, they are a professional, and how much time would it take for them to chart out like a portfolio allocation plan, and how much time would it recurringly take? Would it be something that they'll have to look at every week? How passive can somebody be?
I think, and it's a very good question. If you are clear about your objectives, you can probably set that template for your financial advisor. So for example, you know, if you think about controlling risk and setting returns free, which will depend upon the market cycle. In fact, even quizzing from time to time your advisor that how come this fund is giving such good returns? You know, so we see that a lot in the Western world, you know, where people ask that question, you know, why is this fund doing so much better? I mean, is there an additional amount of risk I should know about? So if you have parameterized your advisory relationships, which basically means that, you know, you are saying that I want cyclical, counter-cyclical assets. Within counter-cyclical, I want liquidity, core, and satellite. This is what I think a core bucket should be, which is, you know, it should not have maturity of more than, let's say, 2-3 years, just as an example, could be 5 years. it should have a predominantly AAA government bond profile. And this is my satellite allocation. Please allocate as XYZ percentage into these three. Keep telling me what portion is in countercyclical and what portion is in cyclical assets. And the test of the financial advisor in this case would be that part of your countercyclical bucket should not start behaving like a cyclical bucket when the chips are down.
Yeah.
Right? So the test is not necessarily that they have maximized return for you. The test is that they have selected the right fund profile, which behaves the way it's intended to at various points in time in the cycle.
Suyash, now these are questions that we often get for our guests from like anybody who's viewing and who's listening. People generally would want to know who are the investors you admire the most. If you could like list somebody and like talk about why, what you like about them.
So this is the point where I truly and fully, if I haven't so far, try, you know, start to disappoint you. I honestly, and I'm not just saying this to be, you know, politically correct or anything of the sort. So one thing, I can't read nonfiction books. It's a, you know, very shameful secret, if anything, but because I've had to do a lot of such appearances over the last 8-9 months, it's now known by more people than just me and my family. I just cannot read a nonfiction book. It has to be fiction. I have tried many times. I have failed. Similarly, I have a loose interest in, you know, people in the market. I do draw upon the perspectives that they share from time to time. But I don't necessarily idolize people outside of music. And that too, I think, as time has progressed, I've stopped idolizing. I do find that a lot of my waking hours go into reading about, you know, markets, about other people's perspectives. And just to be clear, I do draw upon a lot on other people's perspectives. And, you know, many things that I that we say we write are not original at all, right? But that's what we are in. I personally am interested in is just looking at more and more perspective from people. We have to look at a lot of data. We have to look at a lot of research reports. We have to do a lot of our own research as well. And therefore, the half hour types that I get at end of day, I just devote to fiction. So I'm in some sense preempting your next question about what my favorite investment book is.
So I was going to ask you that. Let me rephrase that though. So my question would have been what your favorite books were. But let me ask you what your favorite fictional book is, which you've like somewhat drawn investing inspiration from.
Look, I think perspective is a very valuable thing, and so is imagination. So what I am continually amazed with is, you know, one, the kind of perspective that various people bring to the table on various things. So, you know, I may just read a report which just bowls me over in the kind of perspective it shares. But I may find, you know, the next report from that same author not as awe-inspiring. But that doesn't mean that author is not very good. It's just that, you know, there's some perspective about it that I've just not thought about. Similarly, imagination. And I do think, you know, one should not slot oneself too much as to the way one's mind is thinking, etc. Because, you know, you can draw inspiration from anything whatsoever. I think one of the most imaginative things I've ever read is Lord of the Rings by Tolkien. I know it's well in the history. I actually read it in, I think, 1999 or somewhere last. But I do think, you know, it is one of very, very imaginatively written pieces with a lot of wisdom thrown in very casually. So if I have to, I would probably say that one.
Thanks, Suyash. I mean, this was great in terms of like getting to know about you, in terms of getting to know about the markets through you. I'm sure that our viewers would want like more of you. So I hope we can have you here again.
No, absolutely, Mohit. It's been a pleasure. I think, you know, this interaction has been very personally joyful for me, and look forward to whenever you call me next.
Mutual fund investments are subject to market risks. Read all scheme-related documents carefully.